So every now and then I try to explain to younger journalists how crazy life was back in the day at Sports Illustrated. And when they don't believe me, I turn to a page in my old diaries. And here's a good example. October 9th, 2002, 6:46 a.m., New York City. I'm flying to California for Game 1 of the World Series after a ridiculous amount of drama and stupidity. Following the final game of the NLCS, I wrote a CNNSI.com column on Kenny Lofton, asshole. The column got some hype in California, and somehow that was translated into a huge problem in New York. I'm not sure why. Maybe a bad combination of PR and baseball bullshit. Anyhow, I was told by Mike Bevins, my editor, that I might not be going to the World Series, which, save for principle, was 100% fine with me. I was pissed off. It was the typical no support bullshit. Yesterday, after discussions with Bevins, I was 99% certain I wasn't going. And I even axed my reservation. Then yesterday at about 3:30 p.m., Bevins called me in to tell me that I could go, but that I would have to avoid all publicity. That was fine. Then he asked, "Do you understand why we're mad about this?" I told him flat out no. That pissed him off. He went off on a spree about how irresponsible I was and how I was like a college kid and how I don't understand what's wrong, that I probably shouldn't be writing for Sports Illustrated. I was livid. I yelled back loud and long, "There's no support here. Whenever I write anything you don't like, I'm reverting. Well, I don't say anything when you guys edit my story and insert a word that I don't even understand. I don't get mad at you guys when you write stuff that was used two sentences earlier. Anyhow, now I'm on a runway and I'd rather be snuggling at home with the wife. So you can't win in this world." My name is Jeff Perlman. I'm the New York Times bestselling author of 10 books and the host of Two Writers, Sing and Yang, the podcast where one writer, me, talks writing with another writer every single week. And today's guest is Aria Gerson, the Vanderbilt beat writer for the Nashville Tennessean. This is episode number 309. Let's sling some yang.
Dad, your podcast sucks.
And nobody cares about your stupid TV show.
All right. First of all, thank you for joining me here. I appreciate it. Whenever I have a young Tennessean writer on, I always say it's like talking to the ghost of Christmas past, or vice versa, the ghost of Christmas future. As you know, as I said, I started my career in Nashville first as an intern in 1993, then as a staff writer in 1994. You started your career coming out of Michigan. You went to college, you attended the University of Michigan, you wrote for the Michigan student newspaper, you had various internships through the years. When I was coming along, the idea of working for a newspaper was thrilling and exciting and enrapturing, and everyone in my student newspaper wanted to start their careers in newspapers. Is that still a thing?
I definitely think that calculus has changed a little bit, because there's a lot of different ways that you can get into the industry. Like, some people are more interested in editing or the digital side, and other people, you know, The Athletic was an outlet that started when me and my peers were in high school. So that was something that informed a lot of our approaches, that like a lot of people wanted to write for, or something like Sports Illustrated. But I personally actually, I didn't really care which outlet I worked for, whether it was newspaper or digital, but I had a specific type of job in mind that I wanted. And it was the type of job that is more found at newspapers, which was, I did want to do beat writing, which is kind of unique among some of my peers. A lot of my peers did not want to do beat writing, but I did. Coming out of Michigan and having had experience with that, I knew that was what I liked to do. So I was looking for specifically beat writing jobs. And of course, most of those jobs that are available to recent college grads are at newspapers. So that's how I got started. But, you know, I had a lot of friends who went other paths. Like I said, they started in editing, or they started in digital, or, you know, things like that. So there's definitely a wider range of paths now that people want to take. And I think people kind of figure out through internships and things like that, which of those paths they want to take. And I think that's kind of cool.
Wait, why would you want to be a beat writer?
Yeah. So I've been asked that a lot. And I think it's just the way that I approach writing is sort of, I like to be around a team. I like to be around a team because I feel like that's where I get all my ideas from. The more you see, the more you start to ask questions, and the more you know, the more you can kind of inform your answers to those questions. And so I learned that at Michigan, where, you know, there's like tons of beat writers. You would have 50 people at every press conference for Michigan. So I had to be really creative when I was a student, especially because as student reporters, we didn't have the same sources that people who had worked on that beat since the 1990s had. So I tried to be really creative and come up with stories that other people weren't necessarily writing. And a lot of those stories did come from just my time having been around the team and around the school and generated those ideas. And I liked that idea of covering a team day to day and then using the things that I saw there and the questions that I had there to inform further, more in-depth coverage of the beat. And that's kind of what I've done with Vanderbilt too, is just like, I feel like it's not as easy to get those ideas when you're not there every day and when you're not generating those consistent ideas from watching games or just from seeing, you know, how people interact and that kind of thing. I personally wanted a job that was different every day, that had variety rather than just sitting at a desk. And so personally, that was what was a good fit for me coming out of college.
Right. So you wrote a piece October 7th, 2020 for the Michigan Daily. The 2017 Michigan State game was the best and worst of Michigan fandom. And you wrote, before it became my job to attend Michigan football games, I spent one season as a fan in the student section. Just my luck. It happened to be 2017, unquestionably the most forgettable year of the Harbaugh era. I attended every home game that season from my seats in the 20th row in the end zone. But if you asked me anything about any of those games beyond which team won, I wouldn't be able to tell you much, except for one. Before the Michigan-Michigan State game 3 years ago Wednesday, students were given maze rally tallies that read, "Beat State." In the top corner of mine, blue bled into the maze from when the towel was so wet the colors ran. The Wolverines did not, in fact, beat Michigan State. It was an objectively terrible game, one that featured five turnovers and a lot of incompletions. The 2017 Michigan-Michigan State game was the most disappointing loss and the most disappointing season of the Harbaugh era. In many ways, there's a turning point of the way people perceived Harbaugh's tenure, the beginning of the narrative of a coach that can't beat his rivals or win big games. So you spent a year going to Michigan games before you started writing about Michigan. Do you think it helps a writer to have a fan's perspective before he or she, they go into the actual coverage of a team?
I think at Michigan, it did help me, and not just to have been a fan myself, but to know other fans, because I knew a lot of people who went to that game and who remembered that game. So that was kind of why I had that idea to write that column that I did. And I think that, you know, it can just give you a different perspective. It can let you know, I think, what fans are thinking about and what their mindset is. Now, that being said, I also decided after I graduated that I didn't want to cover Michigan anymore. That was an active decision. There was actually a Michigan job that came open right around that time, and I decided not to go for it because I just wanted to separate myself from that and to start something different. So
wait, this is actually really interesting. You're an aspiring journalist, you're an aspiring beat writer, you know Michigan, you've covered Michigan as a college writer. Job comes open, you literally do not apply for it?
Correct.
Were you torn on this at all?
No, not really. I think it was one of those things. Like I said, the fan perspective, I did think it helped me as a journalist, but it also, covering Michigan kind of gave me an idea that I wanted to not cover Michigan, and I wanted that to be something that was tied more to my college days. I didn't want that to be my job, like, full time professionally. So when the job came open, I was just like, actually, I was honest with myself. I was like, actually, I don't want to do this. I want that to be something that is kind of, I can still be a fan of it, and I can still, you know, look back on those days, but professionally, I wanted to go a different direction.
Wow. I know we're in the pros now, but I'm fascinated by something in college. You're a student journalist in Michigan. You went to games your first year. You cheered on Michigan. You hope they did well. Did you struggle at all with the adjustment of, all right, it's not we anymore, it's they? And also, Do you feel like people expected you to be rooting for Michigan as a student journalist at Michigan?
Yeah, I did sometimes get that misconception that people thought that I was a fan, but it wasn't a super hard adjustment for me just because. So first of all, before I started covering football, I did cover other sports. I covered field hockey and gymnastics and softball. Those are the first ones I really covered my freshman year. And so I was kind of used to the idea of like having to act professionally and act objectively and to not, you know, get in the way of that. And then when I started covering football, I actually started by stringing games for AP my sophomore year. So I would just work at home games and run quotes basically. So that was my first year in the press box. And then I started covering the team like fully my junior year. So it was kind of a slower transition in that way. And I knew other people who had covered football and I knew what working at the games entailed before I got into it. And it was one of those things where if, you know, I knew that it was something I actually, when I started my freshman year, I was not sure if it was something I wanted to do, but I later decided that it was something that I wanted to do. And so just being honest with myself on that choice, I think kind of helped from that perspective and just having had that experience of having covered other sports before I covered football, also helped a lot, but I definitely did sometimes get that misconception and it was frustrating because I was like, you know, just because we're students, I think, you know, people would make certain assumptions that we knew, you know, we know how to be professional too. And if we were not being professional, you know, they make that announcement, at least at Michigan, they made an announcement before every game. They were like, if you cheer for the team, like, we might kick you out of the press box, basically. Wow. Like we had that same announcement. We were subject to those same rules as everybody else. And at Michigan, it was also kind of unique. You know, they would credential fan sites or blogs too. There were fan sites and blogs that openly were, you know, from a pro Michigan standpoint that would be going to the press conferences and the games. And they were subject to the same rules at the games that we were. So I think there was room for a lot of different perspectives there. And, you know, again, it was just everybody was new before they got those credentials that they had to be subject to those rules.
Are you comfortable with this idea of, I mean, maybe you've grown up with it, with this idea that we're going to credential fanboy sites? You're sitting in the press box. You are clearly dedicated to the professionalism of journalism. And you're sitting next to the guy who's writing, you know, tweeting out Go Big Blue. You cool with that? You comfortable with that? Is that weird for you?
I think it just depends on the person and the site and what they're doing, because I have encountered some fan sites in my time. I think in this day and age, like there are some fan sites who do some really interesting things. For instance, one of the big Michigan fan sites is MGo Blog. And I always checked out MGo Blog for their really in-depth like film breakdowns. They had probably the best film breakdowns of anybody and the best like analytical, like from a football X's and O's standpoint breakdowns. And I thought they were great. Wow. And sometimes people from MGo Blog would come to the games, you know, to get quotes on things from Jim Harbaugh. And I thought, you know, that was their right as long as they, you know, again, follow the same rules that the rest of us have. But there have been times where I did encounter people who were not quite following that same standard of professionalism. And I think that's when it can become an issue. So I think it just depends on the site they're writing for, if they're willing to put that aside for the time that they're at the game or the press conference. And, you know, like I said, there are some fan sites that do really good work. So it just kind of depends for me.
So this is definitely the cranky old man in me, but I I hate, with some exception, Division I men's basketball and football coaches. I hate the bluster. I hate the self-importance. I hate the God complex. I hate the fawning. I hate everything about it. I hate everything about it. I'm just being honest. I really do. You covered Harbaugh as a undergrad in Michigan. Am I missing something about him? What was he like to cover?
Yeah, so it's definitely Harbaugh is definitely, I would say, controversial among college football reporters. The biggest thing that I learned as a student is that you couldn't really get info from him. You had to try to get info through other avenues. So at Michigan, Harbaugh would talk every Monday. He'd have his press conference and it would last for like, I don't know, like 20 minutes. And he just wouldn't say anything. Like, you could ask him questions and he often wouldn't really answer them. And he was sometimes like he had kind of a hostile demeanor a lot of times. I would say he was equally hostile to everybody. I wouldn't necessarily think that, you know, there's some coaches I've heard that treated student journalists worse than regular other people. For Harbaugh, it to me at least felt like I wasn't necessarily treated any worse. It was just that he kind of was not super media friendly in general. But what I will say about Michigan is that every week we got two assistant coaches and they rotated through the assistant coaches. So we got coordinators fairly often. We got position coaches, and the position coaches and the coordinators were actually very useful to talk to. And if you wanted something explained in depth, they would explain it to you. So for me, with my job at the student newspaper, I could kind of write whatever I wanted. I didn't necessarily have to get a quote from Harbaugh. So I got used to asking myself, do I need Harbaugh to talk about this thing? Or can I ask like the coordinator about it? Because if I ask the coordinator, they'll give me a better answer. Right. And most of the time I was able to just ask the coordinator about it and it would make the story better anyway. It was if you needed a quote specifically from Harbaugh that it would be more of an issue. But I think it's just sort of about figuring out like who is the best person to ask that can answer your question, because it's not necessarily always the head coach.
I'm an adjunct professor out here at Chapman University. It's my final college related question for you. And they print out their paper a couple of times a year. They stop printing it regularly, but they print it out. And I just see it lying there. Like it just lies there, the printed issues. Do college students still care about college newspapers?
I think they do to an extent, but it's just sort of in a different way that they engage with it than they used to. So at the Michigan Daily, when I was a student before COVID, we actually used to still print every day except for Saturday and Sunday. And they would kind of, the print papers often were not picked up. I would pick them up. I'd read them in the dining hall, but people who lived off campus, especially at Michigan, a lot of students live off campus. And if you lived off campus, like there was no reason to pick up a print paper ever. So people would often read it online, especially the sports coverage, the investigative work and things like that. People would still engage with it, but it would be more online or on social media. So we beefed up our social media strategy when I was there, especially once COVID hit, because then we really had to be doing everything online. And I think that, you know, like I said, there was actually during the Big Ten championship game, there was actually a photo, or not a photo, they showed on the broadcast of somebody holding up a front page of the Michigan Daily. So there is still a level of engagement with it, but it's just sort of in a different way that you have to figure out what are the best ways to reach your audience. And those are the conversations that a lot of student newspapers have. And I know that even after I graduated, the Daily has done other stuff to try to do that I, you know, wasn't really privy to, but it's just sort of a figuring out how to meet your audience where they are, I think.
I don't know if you saw this somewhat recently, the University of Kansas student newspaper had a front page and in big font, it said big. And then it had a picture of Grady Dick. And then it said energy. And the thing went viral, the headline. I actually loved it. I thought that was really smart and really clever. I guess you just got to figure out different ways to do it.
Yeah, we used to go big on those headlines too for our Monday sports covers. And we'd post the headlines and the front pages on Twitter. And so there's definitely been a few really good ones. Like Blake Corum was Michigan's star running back. When Michigan beat, I believe it was Nebraska, they did a cover that was Children of the Quorum, and they imitated the Children of the Corn like movie poster. Uh-huh. And that one did really well on social media. People really liked that one. So I was not the person who was in charge of doing those covers. That was, you know, more the design section. But that is definitely something that I think a lot of student papers do now, and they can have a little bit of fun with it.
You seem a little old schooly. Like, you work for a newspaper, you cover Vandy. Do you wish you came along in an age where Twitter just wasn't a thing, and clicks weren't a thing, and social media impressions weren't a thing, and TikTok? Like, you ever just want to fucking write an article and not worry about all this shit?
Yeah, I mean, honestly, I like using Twitter for work. I think there's a lot of things that you can get from it. So I use Twitter to engage more directly with the fan base and to provide maybe a little bit of extra content that some of the diehard fans are kind of looking for that doesn't necessarily fit in either the print or online papers, but that some people might want. You know, I host Twitter spaces every week. And I think on Twitter, part of the thing that I like to use it for too is just searching. Like, you can search, you know, I can search for Vanderbilt or Vandy Boys or whatever it is and find people talking about it. I can find information more easily. And I can also go back to the past. Like, say I want to know like what people thought of a recruit when, like a player when they were in high school. And I can go on Twitter and search like that person's name before a certain date, and I can pull that all up. And so I do think that partly has to do with me being brought up in it. I've used Twitter since I was in high school, so I know all the tricks. And I think that I have, having been brought up in it, I have figured out how to use it in such a way that it helps my reporting and my engagement with the fan base. I was able to pretty much build an audience through Twitter while I was in college, and that was something that was very helpful to my career. So while I think it has definitely its pros and cons, I think there's a lot of drawbacks to kind of that click-driven model. But at the same time, I couldn't imagine doing the job without it, just because there's so many different positive things that I've learned about using social media in that way as well.
I actually think one of the great underrated things about Twitter is as a research tool. And I think most people view it as a place to put out their thoughts and get angry. And it's just as good, in many ways better than a simple Google search in finding a million different things. I think it's a vastly undervalued research tool.
Oh, I definitely agree. And that's sometimes, you know, people with all the controversy about Twitter lately, there's been people who've asked me like if I'm going to leave Twitter or go to a different site. And I said, no, like as long as Twitter is still up, if I moved to a different site, I would lose like the number one most valuable thing I use Twitter for, which is the search tool. I use it to search all kinds of stuff. And that, you know, if you go over to a different site, that site doesn't have that stuff. So sometimes, you know, I think especially in the sports world, you have people who don't necessarily post articles that could be found on Google, or they don't post full blown, you know, things, but on Twitter, you can find their thoughts and you can find what people are saying. You can even sometimes find like research that other people have done. If you know how to search, I'm really good at using Twitter search. So like, I agree. I think for doing research, it's such a great tool, and that journalists, you know, if you know how to use Twitter in the right way to search, and also to find people, like say you want to talk to somebody who has a certain quality about them. Twitter is like by far the easiest way to find those people and to reach out to those people. And so I think that it can be used as a valuable tool in a lot of different ways that aren't just sharing your work.
As I mentioned, 30 years ago, God help me, I'm in my senior year at the University of Delaware. I'm applying for jobs everywhere. And I really get one offer. It's a Nashville, Tennessee. And I moved to Tennessee. I start my career. Here we are 30 years later, or 2021. You're in Michigan. You start your career at the Nashville, Tennessee. And how'd you get the job? How'd you even find out about the job? How'd this come to be?
I was always kind of going back to when I was doing internships in college. I was always kind of that, like, I'm just going to apply for everything person. And I got really good at navigating job search websites and finding internships and stuff that I could apply to. So when I was getting ready to graduate, I would say I started in about February. I started looking for jobs on all the different jobs boards that I knew of. And I just kind of started applying to all the jobs I thought that were open. I started actually I started by applying to jobs that I thought would be the best fit. And I said, I'll see what happens with this round. And if I don't get these jobs, then I'll just start applying to like every job that I see. So I started especially with college jobs because that was what most of my experience was at that time, covering college. So Vanderbilt was a job that happened to be open at that time when I was starting. I think it was around March that I applied for it. I applied for this job as well as a couple other college jobs that were open. But I think that one of the things that specifically made Vanderbilt position really interesting, again, I wasn't being particularly discerning with which colleges it was. I was just like, well, you know, it's a college job and it's open, so I'll apply for it. But one connection that I specifically had to Vanderbilt is that when I was in college, one of the random internships that I did that I managed to find out about was I worked at the Cape Cod Times. And what I did when I was there was I covered the Cape Cod Baseball League, which is like for college baseball players. And obviously Vanderbilt is really a power in college baseball. So from my summer on the Cape, I had a lot of connections in the college baseball world. And I don't necessarily know if that helped me get the job, but it helps the job appeal to me because I was like, wait a minute, this involves doing college baseball. And this is a really niche field that I actually have connections in and that I actually know some things about. And I had watched Vanderbilt play Michigan for the national title in 2019. So it was a program that I knew a little bit about and that I had some connections in. And that was part of why it appealed to me, because I was looking to do something a little bit different from Michigan, but it wasn't a totally like new, like I have no idea what this even is type of job. It was something that I had a little bit of connection to prior. And the fact that it was a little bit niche did appeal to me because it meant that I could kind of dictate what I wanted to do a little bit, and that it wasn't as reliant on just, you know, whenever the, you know, having to get Jim Harbaugh's name in a headline or something. So that job really did appeal to me for those reasons. So when I was interviewing for it, again, it was just sort of, I took the job because it was the first one that I happened to be offered. And I was like, okay, I'll take it. It wasn't necessarily anything super discerning, but there were certain reasons that the job appealed to me. And when I was applying for it, I think that did probably help during the interview process.
I feel like I'm talking to me 30 years later. I swear to God, like coming out of college, I was like, number one, I don't want to be anywhere near Delaware. Number two, I'm just going to apply everywhere. And I tell my students all this. You honestly, you exemplify this. There's a difference between people who want it and people who want it. You'll meet a lot of journalism students who are like, I really want to be a journalist. Well, would you be willing to move to Tennessee and cover? Well, I don't know. I kind of want to stay in this area, or I want to stay near my girlfriend, or I want to stay near my boyfriend. I want to do this. You just really wanted it. Am I wrong?
Yeah, I would say that I am from a unique background as well, in that I have lived in a lot of different places. So I was born in New Hampshire. I lived in Utah for a while as a kid. I moved to Michigan when I was in middle school, and I graduated from high school in Michigan. Went to the University of Michigan. I, you know, then did the Cape Cod internship. So I have lived in a lot of different places. And one of the things that did for me is it didn't really make me feel like I was tied down to any one particular place. So when I was graduating, that was one of the things I said was like, I don't really care where it is, with some exceptions. Like there were a few places where I was like, I probably don't want to live here, but for the most part, I said, I don't really care where it is. Like, I'll go anywhere. I have family like all over the place. So I kind of was willing to go with an open mind to jobs that might, you know, and I was kind of open-minded about like what jobs might be a fit. I wasn't looking for name. That was something that I learned very early on when I did the Cape Cod Times internship, because I loved that internship. And it was not, you know, it wasn't like, and I did a big name internship too at USA Today. And I liked that one too. But I found that, you know, it doesn't necessarily matter if it's a big name or if it's something people have heard of or if it's, you know, popular or whatever. It's more about figuring out what's a fit for you. And I kind of figured out while I was in college, you know, what kind of things were fit for me. And I was willing to do, you know, like I was willing to move. I knew that I had to be willing to move and to do certain things in order to get one of those positions. But I kind of had had enough of those unique experiences that weren't necessarily the biggest names that I knew to go in with an open mind.
Before we continue with two writers slinging, a fucking quick word from our sponsor.
Hey, this is Jeff Perlman, and I'm here with my wife, Catherine, who's super excited about the Boston Philly series. Do it.
Go. I can't.
Royal Rangers has all your USFL needs, and this is what happens when my really bad acting wife can't handle a simple ad. So go to RoyalRetros.com. I'm using this as the ad this week.
All right, so what are the keys of walking into a brand new beat? You arrive in Nashville. You're not from Nashville. You take over the Vanderbilt beat. That means you're covering multiple sports at Vandy. What are the issues that come with that?
Yeah, well, the biggest issue that I had when I started. So I started in May of 2021. And for those of you who know the college baseball calendar, this was a week before the SEC baseball tournament. And Vanderbilt at that time was ranked, I think, in the top five. This was like a national title contending team. And I was starting a week before the postseason. And everything was on Zoom because of COVID.
Right.
So that was very difficult because there was, you know, first of all, I'm walking into this team in the middle of the season and they're a national title contending team that's getting a lot of attention. I need to figure out who is even on the roster. Like I knew a couple of their players, but I didn't, you know the full team. I didn't have any connections really. Like I'd never talked to the coach before or anything. And on some level, like we did have a limited number of in-person. So there were not a lot of COVID restrictions in Nashville at that time. So about maybe like a week after I started my job or 2 weeks, I'm not really sure. I was able to go to an in-person availability with the baseball coach. And they did it outdoors. So I was able to like talk to him in person. But at the NCAA events, at the SEC tournament, at the NCAA tournament, they were not allowing in-person media access, which meant that I had not met any of the players in person. I was talking to them like on the phone or on Zoom, and I hadn't ever met them, which was difficult for me because, like, again, you know, people want to put a name to a face. They want to say, like, I was in here and I was like this random person that nobody knew who I was. And I was having to try to talk to all these players and I was having to try to do a lot of in-depth features because they were going to the College World Series. And that aspect of it was quite difficult because it was the mixture of a lot of different things. So I had to be a little bit creative and I had to, you know, send a lot of emails and just try to do whatever I could to get connections there and to get through. You know, there were players on the baseball team that I did not talk to in person until last spring, nearly a year after I'd started the job, just because of how the COVID stuff shook out. So that was definitely the most difficult part of it. And I think a lot of it was just, I had to do a lot of research and just be like, okay, who's on this team? What are they doing? Like, what are the most important like things about this team, and prove that I knew my stuff both to the players, the coaches and the fans. And I do think that my experience with the Cape Cod League did help there. Because right after the College World Series, some of the players went to the Cape Cod League and I was able to demonstrate that I knew what that was. Right. So I actually called some of the coaches from the Cape League that like had Vanderbilt players. I was like, yo, like we talk Vanderbilt players. And so I talked to them and I talked to one of the players as well who was on the Cape. And so I think it was just having to do that all so quickly without even having the ability to meet everybody in person that made it difficult.
Does it make a difference? We'll just use Jack Leiter as an example, who you covered last year at Vandy. Does it make a difference if he knows you, knows who you are? Does that actually make a difference?
I think it does make a difference. I think that, you know, I did profile Jack Leiter. I spoke to him on the phone and it was fine. You know, I don't want to make it sound like I had a bad experience with Jack Leiter because I, you know, hadn't met him. I wrote a story on him. It went really well. You know, I talked to him on the phone. It was great. But I do think that there is a difference when you can establish that connection with players, coaches, fans, with people knowing who you are and that you are around and that you do know what you're talking about. Because I think it just kind of aids that level of familiarity, I think, and that level of trust, in the sense that I think again, like with somebody like Jack Leiter, I'm sure that Jack was used to speaking to a lot of random people because there was a lot of national media that was around that wanted to talk to him. So I'm sure that he was like, you know, every week it would be like, oh, like here's another random person that you have to talk to. And so I'm sure that he was accustomed to that. But I think that it's definitely far easier and less awkward. And I think when you can have somebody who knows, like specifically who you are and has talked to you before and all of that kind of stuff.
When I showed up at the Tennessean, there was a newsroom. There was a big office, which doesn't exist anymore. The building on 1100 Broad, you would walk in. Hey, hey, hey. You'd stop at the library. You'd talk to people. You'd stop in the newsroom. You'd talk to people. You'd sit there with your co-workers. It'd be very collegial in a sense of like, well, what are we working on? Does that still exist? The we?
I do know some of my colleagues. I think it depends, because I don't go to the office that often just because I'm often working at Vanderbilt and my schedule is weird. I don't work regular hours. I don't work 9 to 5. So like sometimes when I'm in the office is different from when other people are in the office. And there's some people who don't go to the office at all and they just work remotely. I do try to get to know a lot of my other coworkers, and I do know a lot of them, particularly if they are in the office a lot, or sometimes we have events that we host. Sometimes it's like when people leave, we'll have a going away party for them, or when people, sometimes we just decide to have a get together, and that will be like, we'll meet at a local brewery or something and just hang out. And I like to go to those events because I do like to know my coworkers. And I do think that there's a lot of knowledge that you can be gained from knowing your coworkers and from having a relationship with the people that you work with. But I also think that there is a sense of, you know, you have to also be able to work remotely, because for instance, I work with several different editors, and some of my editors live in Nashville and some of them do not. Some of them live elsewhere. And so in those cases, I have to, you know, be doing remote meetings and phone calls and text messages and be able to communicate that way as well. So I do think that, you know, for me, knowing my coworkers is very important because I moved to Nashville and I didn't know anybody. So my coworkers, especially in the earlier days where there was still COVID stuff going on, were some of the first people that I even knew in the city. And so that was an important aspect of it for me. But I think that because with journalists, like I said, the hours are very different that everybody's working, especially in sports. So I'm working a lot of weekends and a lot of nights, which means that, again, I'm not in the office from 9 to 5. Like, what would I be doing right half that time? So I think there are sometimes ways that you have to go outside of an office to get to know people. But I do think it's still important.
On October 16th of 2022, you were in Athens, Georgia, and Vanderbilt lost to Georgia 55 to nothing. And it is funny because I mentioned Mike Organ, and Mike Organ was a Vandy beat writer when I was at the Tennessean. I would always joke with him how this team, this shit stain of a team, just keeps getting killed. And here we are 30 years later, and this shit stain of a team keeps getting killed. What is it like to cover a 55-0 loss?
Yeah, I mean, I think the difficult part about that was that So first of all, everybody knew going in that they were going to get killed by both Alabama and Georgia. And they played those two teams in a stretch of 4 weeks. It was like very quick succession. So after I'd already written about the Alabama game, which is sort of like, okay, no, everybody knew that they weren't going to beat Alabama or get close to beating Alabama. You know, they still have like way less talent than Alabama and, you know, whatever. Wrote all that stuff. And then, you know, 2 weeks later, it was basically the same thing. And so it was kind of difficult from that standpoint to be like, okay, is there anything that's different about this than like when they just played Alabama and had the same issue? Because, you know, these are national title contending teams that a lot of teams are losing to. And so I kind of just went with the perspective of like, is there anything that can be learned from these games? And I was trying to say like, here's what this game meant and here's what it didn't mean to try to differentiate that stretch of games, I think. And it did end up being, I mean, Vanderbilt finished 5-7. They ended up winning 2 of their last 3 games after that stretch. And that was one of the things that I had pointed out. I said, well, if you get killed by Alabama and Georgia, I thought playing them at the beginning of the season was better than at the end, because as long as you can get out of there without getting everybody hurt, you know, you have stuff that's on film now that you can look at and be like, okay, well, you know, we can't be doing that or that, and like try to fix it before they played the more winnable teams on their schedule. And I think that that did happen to an extent. So I did kind of have that one point that I made correct, but you definitely have to get more creative, I think, especially when you already know coming into the game, like what's going to happen. Cause that was the thing. It was like very predictable that they lost to Alabama and Georgia in that way. So, you know, you had to kind of try to figure out like a way that wasn't just like, well, we expected this to happen and it happened.
Do you think, based on your sports coverage experience, do you think the Vanderbilt players knew they were going to lose those games?
I think that you wouldn't be a good athlete if you didn't think that you had a chance to win every game. But I think that they knew that their chances were not particularly good. But again, I think that in order to be a high level athlete, you have to have some level of that. Like, well, we can beat this team.
Do you think it is okay for someone who covers a sport to have empathy for the athlete? Is that okay? And can you express that?
I think that you have to have some level of empathy for the people you cover in various ways. You know, not necessarily, I think it goes deeper than just like, oh, well, I feel bad that they lost really badly, but just some of the things, particularly I think in baseball for Vanderbilt, where they're under such a high level of scrutiny because a lot of them are MLB prospects. And sometimes there's stuff that fans say that is really, in my opinion, crosses a line in terms of what, you know, like they're like, this player like shouldn't even be on the team anymore, or like this player is, you know, not, shouldn't be playing at the SEC level, or people will say things like that. And I, you know, do at times think that like that some of that stuff is not appropriate to be said. But, you know, I think that you have to have that kind of relating with some of the things that the players have been through in order to tell the best stories. I think, you know, there's ways that you have to express it. I don't think you should be, you know, going on Twitter and being like, oh, well, like, I, you know, feel bad that, you know, this or that. But when, you know, again, that's how you develop relationships with people, is by kind of knowing on some level what that feels like. And I think that's totally fine. I think, again, it's as long as you're not like, you know, up in the press box, like, oh, that sucks. Like, you know, like, again, there's a baseline level of professionalism that you have to have. But I do think that you kind of have to understand the emotions that go into that.
I just want to say, I love LinkedIn pages. I love LinkedIn pages because most people forget what they have on their LinkedIn page. And I want to say 3 things about you that I enjoy: your license in CPR and first aid, but most importantly, You worked as an usher at the Grand Rapids Civic Theater. What's your best usher experience story?
I worked as an usher while I was in high school at the Grand Rapids Civic Theater is like a community theater. And my sister was in a show there when I was in high school. And I ended up seeing the show so many times because, first of all, I went with my family. Then I worked it too. I think I worked it twice. And so I saw that show like 5 times, just seeing my sister, you know, perform in it. And I think that was really cool. And then being able to tell people that she was in the show.
Wow, you were an usher. Telling people well, as you ushered.
Right. Well, telling the people, it was that I didn't tell the fans so much as I told like other people I was ushering with. I was like, yo, like my sister's in that show. And some of the people that I worked with also had family members who were in the shows, because that was part of the perks of being an usher was you got into the shows for free. So sometimes people would be pulled into it if they had a sibling who was or a family member that was in the show, and then they just use it to go see the show a bunch of times. So that was definitely one of my more interesting ushering experiences. But I think also like it was helpful, like if you volunteered to work the really popular shows that were more expensive or harder to get tickets to, and you could just get into them for free. So that was wow. Like, I was like, well, see, I'm using these hours as my high school required you to do volunteer hours. And I was like, well, I can count these like 4 hours that I worked the show, but really like 3 of those hours are just sitting there and watching the show. And 1 of the hours is actually doing anything. So that's I liked it from that standpoint.
Yeah, that's a nice one. That's a good one. Let me ask you a final question. You're young, you're in this business. You're a young woman in this business. And I have had women of all different ages and experience levels through the years do my podcast. Leslie Visser, who is the first NFL beat writer, she covered the Patriots, and her stories of the locker room are fascinating, but also really jarring in a lot of ways, what she dealt with. And you come along in this era where athletes, male athletes, are used to women in the locker room and are used to women coming along. Do you sense in any way there is a perception at all of, oh, what would she know? Or, oh, she hasn't been through this. Or, oh, she just wants to meet the athletes or anything of that. Or do you feel like we are in an enlightened age for women in sports media where that has largely been shed away?
I think that personally, I've dealt with more of that from fans than I have from players or coaches. I think that on a lot of levels, game recognizes game in terms of if you can prove that you've done your research and you know what you're talking about, I think most athletes are going to recognize that. Now, there is a larger issue in that I think the biggest issue women have sometimes with players and coaches, I haven't experienced this personally, but just, you know, you hear it in the news at times, it's just like potentially harassment or inappropriate behavior from players. But I think that's a different situation from in terms of knowing the stuff or not. Now, it's fans that I will get sometimes, like I'll get tweets or I'll get message board posts or stuff that's like, oh, well, like she's never played a down of football or like, you know, whatever, things like that. Or people who just assume, I think sometimes like I've gotten comments before that were like assuming that I was younger than I was, infantilizing me, or that I like wasn't a professional. But again, that was more from the fan standpoint than from the player or coach standpoint. And so I do have to deal with some of that, like people making rude comments about me online. I think that's definitely one of the biggest things that women have to deal with that men don't have to deal with as much. But again, as far as like the player and coach standpoint goes, I've had a pretty good experience there. And I know that, again, like some of the experiences have been mixed in terms of we need to make sure that players and coaches are not harassing women and that they don't think that that's appropriate. And again, that's never happened to me personally, but there's enough times that it has happened to people that it is still a big problem and that we need to make sure that is something that does not happen in this industry because nobody should be harassed for doing their job. But I think that as far as just sheer knowledge of the sport. I think that it's easier to demonstrate that and that people recognize that more than they used to.
Have you had your athlete, coach, administrator, someone particularly pissed off at you experience yet?
Yeah. I mean, I've had a couple of instances where people have gotten mad about things that I wrote, but I've found that generally, for me at least, I was able to kind of just talk it out. You know, you calmly have a discussion of this is what happened and this is why I did this. And, you know, if you need to speak about why we published this story, you know, you can talk to me or you can talk to my editor. I think that editors provide a lot of support there when it comes to, like, if somebody's getting mad, they can kind of tell you what to say. For me, I haven't had anything that has persisted. I know that other people, you know, have had varying experiences with that. But I've found that if you can have, when I've been able to have a calm conversation about it, generally it's been fine because they know that I'm there every day and that I have a job to do, and so do they. And I think as long as you can come to that realization, it ends up diffusing a lot of conflicts that pop up.
Well, listen, I appreciate your time a whole lot. I love your path. I love your passion for this work. I love that you're writing at my old haunt. And yeah, I wish you a ton of luck. Thank you so much for doing this.
Thank you.
I want to thank today's guest, Aria Gerson, for joining me on Two Writers Slinging Yang. You can follow Aria on Twitter at @Aria_Gerson and read her work in The Tennessean. If you have a chance and enjoy Two Writers Slinging Yang, please go to the vehicle of your choice and leave a nice review. I'd really appreciate it. Music is by the amazing MC White Owl. Thanks again for joining me. And remember, keep writing.